Through 36 episodes of Ann Arbor Stories, we've ended each tale by giving our email address, annarborstories@gmail.com, and asking you, our great listeners, to offer feedback, give us story ideas, or ask us shockingly personal questions. What we've enjoyed the most have been questions about things you've seen or heard related to Ann Arbor's history. We try to give our best answers to the questioner personally, but what we're going to do with this, our first mailbag episode, is share these questions and answers with all our listeners and create a few mini Ann Arbor episodes. Our email address is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so ask your questions, offer your tips, and share your feedback at annarborstories@gmail.com. Let's get to the mailbag. This is an Ann Arbor Stories mailbag. I'm Rich Reddy. Nathan emailed us and wrote, "I have a story request, if they are accepted." Editor's note, they are. What is the history of the Argus Camera Company? How did they come to produce such a popular camera and eventually come to be sold off and leave the city? Great question, Nathan, and a bit of a story here. Back in 1931, the International Radio Corporation debuted the Cadet with a K radio, which was about the size of a loaf of bread, much smaller than the currently available models that were 2 feet long or came in bulky cabinets. By 1933, these small radios were being sold nationwide, particularly popular in big cities like New York, where apartments didn't have a lot of room for giant radios. The Cadet also came with a storage battery, which allowed people to leave the house with it, making it by default the first mass-produced car radio as well. Why is this significant? The International Radio Corporation was an Ann Arbor company. It was started to create industry in Ann Arbor during the Great Depression, formed by inventor, genius, and hustler Charles A. Verschuer and Ann Arbor businessman and future mayor William Brown Jr. They scraped together $10,000 and bought an old furniture factory at 405 4th Street on the west side of Ann Arbor, which is today called the Argus Building 2. We'll get to that name in a second. On that site, they made Verschuer's radios and oodles of money, employing 150 workers by 1936 and posting $2.7 million worth of sales the following year. Business was great in the winter when radio signals were strongest, but lagged in the summer when, apparently, radio signals are much weaker. The reason? No leaves in winter to interrupt the signal. To keep making money in the summer, they brainstormed to create the perfect summer product and landed on the camera. Verschuer copied the expensive but popular German 35mm Leica camera, created an inexpensive and mass-producible product of comparable quality for $1,250. They created a subsidiary company called Argus, and the Argus Model A came out in the summer of 1936. Montgomery Ward sold 30,000 of them in the first week. 3 years later, an updated model called the C3 became Argus's top seller, pulling in more money than anything they'd released before or after. In the heart of the Depression, Ann Arbor was providing the nation with more radios and more cameras than anywhere else in the country. The camera business boomed while the radio business leveled off, so in 1939, International Radio Corporation sold the radio manufacturing business and Argus became its own company. When competition on the camera front heated up, with Kodak and other competitors gaining market share, Argus made a smart move and reached out to the U.S. military, obtaining defense contracts for things like gun sights, rangefinders, periscopes, and bomb sights, and threw Ann Arbor behind the war effort. The contracts brought millions of dollars and hundreds of jobs to Ann Arbor, also likely saving thousands of troops with quick, mass-produced quality optics equipment. The Argus C3 was also used by a number of prominent war photographers, giving it an additional commercial boost during and following the war. After the war, Japanese and German competitors overtook the market, and Argus was bought by Sylvania in 1959. Sylvania was sold in 1969, and camera production was suspended. Somewhere in there, Argus became Argus Camera Company, LLC, operating as a subsidiary of Hartford Computer Group, Inc., based in Inverness, Illinois. Argus still has a little juice left. In 2009, they won a few awards for digital cameras they designed specifically for children to learn how to take pictures with. You can visit the Argus Museum on the second floor of the Argus Building at 525 West William Street in Ann Arbor. Several displays feature some of Argus's rarer cameras, old ads, and even vintage instruction booklets. There's also the Argus 2, where Forth and William meet, which served as the main factory during the Argus War years. Thanks for the question, Nathan. Our second question comes from someone we talked to in a bar once. That person asked, why is there the name Joe in mosaic tiles in the sidewalk at the corner of North 4th Avenue and Ann Street? Good question, person we don't remember. Walk to that corner and look down and you'll see the really cool mosaic described. Red and black and white spelling the name Joe in all caps cursive. This corner building was a bank in 1840, along with an attached house for the bank president and his family to live in. It was converted into a private residence in 1847, and then in 1867 morphed into commercial property and served as a hotel, changing names and owners a few times over the years. In 1913, Joe Parker, owner of Joe Parker's College Saloon, moved his business into this hotel, which was called the Catalpa Inn at the time. The saloon did great business until Prohibition hit in 1920, then they closed, never to reopen. The mosaic remains, J-O-E, once found on the floor inside the former entrance, preserved all these years. One last bit of trivia. Most U of M students have heard the song, I Want to Go Back to Michigan, at some point in their years on campus. The first four lines are, I want to go back to Michigan, to dear Ann Arbor town, back to Joe's in the Orient, and back to some of the money I spent. The Joe's that's referenced is Joe's Parker College Saloon. And now you know the rest of the story. Third question, tweeted to us from Lindsay. She wants to know how the heck some of the streets in Water Hill got their name, mainly Hiscock and Felch. Felch might not seem like a weird name for a street to some, but look it up in dictionaries, both urban and OE, and you'll see why Lindsay's curious. Let's start there. Felch is named after Alpheus Felch, a lawyer by trade who grew up on the East Coast before arriving in Ann Arbor when he was about to turn 40. He made his mark in the Mitten, serving as a state bank commissioner on the state Supreme Court and eventually becoming governor. Then he went to the Senate, and after a long career in politics, returned to Ann Arbor to teach law at the University of Michigan. Streetworthy dude. Hiscock has a similarly impressive but kind of boring origin story. In this case, Charles Hiscock was a banker and a mayor of Ann Arbor from 1897 to 1899. Famous men getting famous street names. Sorry for the lame answer, Lindsay. Next question. Tom emails, what the heck is the Zalgaz Grotto? The Zalgaz Grotto at 2070 West Stadium is a social club affiliated with the Freemasons with a mission of doing community service. Only Master Masons in good standing can join, though many of the social functions are open to the public. Grotto number 34 was founded in Ann Arbor in 1911, with 100 local Masons joining on in the early days. Their member list includes names you definitely recognize from around town. Abbott, Traver, Bonesteel, Almendinger, Ellsworth, Hiscock, and even Gerald Ford. They used to rent the second floor of the old Kresge building at the corner of Main and Washington, where the Mongolian barbecue is today. Then they moved to a few more locations until in 1958, a plot of land on West Stadium Boulevard was willed to them with the sole condition that they had to build the grotto there. They've been there ever since. The grotto hosts a lot of live music events, spaghetti dinners, and burger nights, and still gives back a lot to charities. Last question in this mailbag comes from Jim, who emails, I've driven past the big painted rock near campus 100 times, but have no idea why it's there or why people are always painting it. That's why the library pays us the big bucks, Jim. It all goes back to Eli Gallup, whose name is probably familiar to you if you live in Ann Arbor. Gallup Park is named after Eli Gallup, who was the first superintendent of Ann Arbor's parks, holding the position from 1919 to 1964. Gallup didn't design the layout for Ann Arbor's parks. That credit goes to the Olmsted brothers, whose father designed Central Park in New York. But Gallup put his stamp on all of them, including the addition of the rock at the corner of Washington Hill in Washington Park. It was said that Gallup loved rocks. And in 1932, he spied a giant boulder in a gravel pit on Pontiac Trail, now Olson Park. He knew he had to move it 5 miles south and dump it in a park to honor George Washington's 200th birthday. I'm simplifying a little, but that's essentially the story. Gallup saw a giant chunk of glacial Canadian limestone, convinced the city to pony up the $15 it would take to move it from its home to the park, then directed the workmen and their sturdy Detroit Edison truck to do the Heavy lifting. They laid a concrete foundation below the rock, under which they buried a time capsule that includes details about how the rock got there. Gallup wanted to mount a plaque on the rock, but this was the Great Depression, and copper was scarce. It took him 7 years, but he scrounged up enough from donations, dumpsters, and landfills to finish the shield-shaped plaque and mount it on the face of the rock. It wasn't until the 1950s that painting the rock occurred to someone. And it wasn't a townie. It was a low-down Michigan State football fan. Someone painted the letters MSU on the side of the rock, and someone quickly painted over it. Then someone painted over that, and that, and that. The city tried to clean the rock and keep people from painting on it, but attempts were futile. Layer after layer of paint, year after year. Just how much paint is covering the original rock? In 2010, a writer from the Michigan Daily tried to find out. The author had a source that said it took him 2 days to chip away enough paint to reveal the original plaque. The Daily author, armed with power tools from the future, figured he could get to the original stone face in an afternoon, or rather dead of night, because the author maybe didn't want to get caught. He drilled down in three areas before his drill bit broke. The first was coated in 1.5 inches of paint. The second, 3 inches of paint. And the last, 5 inches of paint. That's a lot of paint. Well, this has been a mailbag episode of Ann Arbor Stories. We want to thank everyone who takes the time to email, tweet, or ask us questions in person. This is how we found some of our most unique stories that we've been able to tell. As always, email annarborstories@gmail.com or check us out on Twitter @AnnArborStories or Instagram @AnnArborStories. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and read by me, Rich Reddy, with amazing questions from all of you. Sound and audio engineering, as always, by Brian Peters. Thanks again for listening.